Dave Andrew Radio Plays brings you The Whitechapel Murders File. This is an account of the horrible events of 1888, when a killer stalked the streets of London's East End, indiscriminately killing women and leaving a trail of terror in his wake. The Whitechapel Murders File recorded the deaths of 11 women, many of whom are regarded to be the victims of the infamous Jack the Ripper. The stories you are about to hear are real. The characters are real. The events are real. Take a step back in time and hear the stories these poor women never got to tell. The Whitechapel Murders File, Episode 5, Mary Jane Kelly.
Whilst murder of any kind is gruesome and hideous, nothing could have prepared the world for what happened next. The brutal slaughter of Mary Jane Kelly. At 25 years old, she was the youngest Ripper victim and generally regarded as the final one amongst the canonical five, although subsequent murders listed on the Whitechapel Murders File may lead you to believe otherwise.
Mary Jane, or Marie Jeanette, as she was also known, was the only victim known to have been killed inside a dwelling, where there was no chance of being overseen nor captured. This meant that more time could be taken to indulge whatever degenerate fantasy this dreadful person had. In our wildest imaginations, we could never dream of carrying out such an atrocity on a fellow human being. Out of respect for her memory, I will not mention in any detail the barbaric act which was inflicted upon her. 135 years may have passed since this horrible event, but the impact of it is still palpable, and I know that I have been affected by it to some degree.
Hello, I am Mary Jane Kelly, and I was born sometime in 1863 in Limerick, Ireland. I have no great memory of that time, only that we left Ireland to move to Carmarthenshire, South Wales, after my father, John Kelly, was offered employment at an ironworks. In 1879, I married a coal miner and became Mrs. Mary Jane Davis. I was just 16 at the time, very young to be a bride, and even younger to be a widow, when around 1881 my husband was killed in a pit explosion. I could no longer stay where I was without him, but fortunately I had a cousin who lived in Cardiff, so I went to stay with her. She was great fun to be with. She knew how to make a living by entertaining men, and soon showed me how to do the same. People always said that I was very pretty, so I never had any difficulty attracting male attention. After a while, I found that Cardiff didn't hold any interest for me anymore, so I moved to London. I found work in a high-class establishment in fashionable Knightsbridge, in the West End no less. One of my closest friends was a French girl who worked there, and I loved to hear her stories in her beautiful accent. She was sophisticated and unlike anybody I'd ever known before. I suppose I was quite influenced by her in a way, so much so that I wanted to be known as Marie Jeanette. It had more of a ring to it than Mary Jane. People may have looked down on me for making my living as I did, but I didn't really care. I was the one who was wearing the most beautiful and expensive dresses, travelling in handsome cabs with equally handsome men, being taken to the theatre or to a restaurant, whilst all the time being paid just for being there. I became the most popular girl in the place, which caused resentment and jealousy sometimes, but that's just the way it goes, I suppose. One of my regulars, Francis Craig, wanted to take me to Paris with him, and I jumped at the chance. I mean, Paris. What young girl wouldn't want to see Paris? I immediately said yes and made plans to travel with him, leaving my trunk of beautiful dresses behind, ready to be sent to me when I had settled. I don't know what I was expecting. I loved seeing the place, but things began to feel a little sinister shortly after we arrived. I realised that Craig's intentions were not as innocent as I had first believed them to be. I had been fooled into going with him so he could sell me on to the highest bidder. I was very grateful for being a good student at school. I was definitely not without intelligence, so I played along for a short time, not letting on that I knew what was going on. Nobody had any cause to believe that I was aware of the danger I was in, which worked in my favour, as I was able to slip away from them unnoticed and make my way back to the docks. They were not the first to underestimate me, and they certainly wouldn't be the last. I returned to England on the next available sailing. Although I had only been away 2 weeks, I knew that everything had changed. What happened to me had been planned from within the house in Knightsbridge. The Madame would definitely have known what was going to happen to me, so I could not return there. It would have been unsafe for me to do so. I found lodgings along the infamous Ratcliffe Highway, not far from the docks. It was very busy and well known, a hive of iniquity, where robbers would be lurking in the shadows, prostitutes would gather to fleece sailors of their shillings, gamblers would lose their money on a nightly basis. There was all sorts going on. It was as lawless as the Wild West sometimes. Secretly, I found it very exciting, if not a little scary at times. I lived with a woman called Mrs. Bookey at first. She was good to me. I told her my story, and she decided that we should go together to the house in Knightsbridge to reclaim my belongings. It was a big mistake on 2 counts. One, my belongings were no longer there, probably sold on or stolen by the other girls who worked there. And two, not long after our visit, a man claiming to be my father came looking for me. I knew at once it was not my father. He had disowned me a long time ago. This man was more likely to be part of the syndicate who trafficked girls from England to Europe, pretty upset with me for springing his trap and wanting to punish me for it. Fortunately for me, I had moved to Breezes Hill and was staying with a Mrs. Carthy at the time, before meeting a builder and moving in with him for a short while. Bless him, he was a very dear man who had designs on marrying me. But I did not feel the same way about him, so it was time to move on once more. This time to a place near Stepney with a man named Morganstone who lived near the gasworks. After him, I briefly lodged with a man named Joseph Fleming who was a plasterer, but I left him and moved to a lodging house in Thrall Street, Spitalfields. I was now in the heart of London's notorious East End, where there were so many people on the streets that it is easy to lose yourself if somebody ever came looking for you. It was whilst I was staying in Thrall Street that I met Joseph Barnett, a porter at Billingsgate Fish Market. There was something about him that attracted me more than any other man ever had. He was very special to me, and I knew that I liked him. He really seemed to like me too, and for who I was. I never had to pretend with Joe. He just got me from the start. Even before our first date was over, he asked whether we could meet again the following day, which we did. It was on that second date that he'd asked me to move in with him, which, strangely enough, I agreed to do. I did not even have to think twice about it before saying yes. We lived in lodgings in George Street, Little Paternoster Row, and then onto Brick Lane, before moving into 13 Miller's Court, Spitalfields. It was not always our decision to leave. We seldom kept up with the rent, and both of us liked to drink too much, which resulted in loud and drunken behaviour sometimes. It was often said of me that I was one of the most decent and nice girls you could ever meet when sober, but I was abusive and quarrelsome when drunk. I suppose I would have to agree with that. With Joe working as a porter at Billingsgate Fish Market, I had all but given up on my previous career. It did not feel right, knowing how I felt about him and how he felt about me. I suppose I looked at it as if we were married. We just got along, most of the time anyway. Things changed a little when he lost his job, though. I was very cross with him for that. I had no intention of going back to my old ways, and now I may not have a choice. It was in one such drunken row that I threw something across the room and smashed a window. As it turned out, this was a good thing. I had lost my door keys, but had a bolt fitted to the inside of the door. I was able to put my arm through the broken window to both open and lock the door. I used to stuff old papers and a man's coat in it at other times to keep out the draught. I was good friends with a few of the girls whom I'd met working the streets, and often I would let them share our room if they did not have enough money to pay for a bed in the lodging house. This upset Joe. He never liked it when I did this. But I could not have seen them out in the cold. I would not have forgiven myself. I think this, along with the heated rows we were having about Joe losing his job, cause him to move out of 13 Miller's Court. I did not want to show him how upset I was, but I hated the fact that he had left. He came to see me most days, though. That part of us was not done with. It was never done with. If he had a few extra shillings, he would make sure that he would give some to me. I think he still loved me. He just couldn't live with me anymore. The last time I saw him was between 7 and 8 o'clock on the 8th of November, 1888. He had come to see me at home, where I was entertaining my friend, Maria Harvey. Before he left, he apologised for not being able to give me any money. I told him that it was all right, that I understood that times were hard. My other friend, Lizzie Albrook, also came for a visit. I had not been drinking much throughout the day, and I was still sober when she was with me. After Joe and Maria had left, I had become quite sombre. I suppose I still hated the fact that Joe was not living with me anymore. I really liked Lizzie. The last thing I wanted for her was to have a life such as mine. So I told her, whatever you do, don't you do wrong and turn out as I have. I also told her that I was heartily sick of the life I was living and that I was thinking of going back to my people in Limerick, which was a strange thing for me to say, really. I can't even recall the last time I was there. After Lizzie left, I decided to go for a drink at the Ten Bells pub, where I met another friend of mine, Elizabeth Foster. I moved on to the Horn of Plenty pub on Dorset Street and sat with a couple of people I know. I think I just wanted to cheer myself up a bit, really, and see what happened from there. As the drink hit home, I became quite drunk, and I got talking to a stout man who had ginger hair, a thick moustache and blotches, wearing a black felt bowler hat. He bought some beer, and we decided to continue our conversation back at Miller's Court. On the way there, we met with my neighbour, Mary Ann Cox, and I told her that I was going to have a song. The neighbours were used to me singing. It was something I loved to do. This was at about 12:45. I sang one of my favourite songs, A Violet Plucked from Mother's Grave, and I was singing until about 1 a.m. the following morning. I decided to go out shortly after this. My gentleman friend had gone, and I went for a walk. I met an old friend on Flower and Dean Street, George Hutchinson, who had been a labourer. This was at about 2 a.m. I asked him if he could spare sixpence, which he told me he could not. I said good night and I carried on walking. Turning into Thrall Street, I bumped into a man of Jewish appearance, around about 35 years old and wearing a hat, which he had pulled down almost to his eyes. I thought I knew him, so I was happy to talk to him. He seemed very friendly. It was getting late, but I thought he was interesting enough, so I invited him to come home with me. Despite his opulent appearance, he may not have secured a lodging house, and I did not like to think of him out on the street all night. I said, "All right, my dear, come along, you will be comfortable." And we started walking back to my place. It was funny, because I saw George Hutchinson again. He passed us by while we were speaking, and he looked very concerned about me. He is such a good friend, but I am a big girl now, and I can take care of myself. I could swear that George followed us home, but I did not want to say anything to him about it. I don't really remember too much about what happened next. I folded my clothing neatly and put it onto the chair. I put my boots next to the fireplace, got into my nightgown, and then into bed. It seemed that man who was with me became almost as big as the room itself, towering over me and shutting out all the light. I saw his hand coming towards my throat and it scared me. I managed to cry out, "Murder!" Everything around me seemed like a dream. I could not lift my head off the pillow. There was movement all around me, but I could not see what it was nor stop it happening. I felt like I was falling through the night sky, with nothing to stop me or break my fall. I was just falling and falling, the darkness rushing up to claim me. Then everything was still.
Two of Mary Jane's neighbours, Elizabeth Prater and Sarah Lewis, had both heard a faint cry of murder between 3:30 and 4 a.m, but had not investigated the source of it. Such cries were commonplace back then, and the only way to summon a police officer was to either find one patrolling the streets or go to your nearest police station. The cry went unreported.
At about 10:45 a.m. on the 9th of November 1888, Thomas Bowyer had been sent by his boss, John McCarthy, who was Mary Jane's landlord, to collect overdue rent amounting to 29 shillings. Having knocked several times at the door, Bowyer tried to enter by engaging the handle, but found the door to be locked. He was aware of the broken window, so he made his way to it, with the intention of speaking to Mary Jane through the broken glass. What he was about to see would affect him for the rest of his life.
Upon discovering Mary Jane's body, he hurried back to John McCarthy and, in evident shock, told him, "Governor, I knocked at the door and I couldn't make anyone answer. I looked through the window and saw a lot of blood." McCarthy told Bowyer to go to the police station on Commercial Road and report his discovery to them, which he did, almost stuttering the words, "Another one. Jack the Ripper. Awful. McCarthy sent me to Inspector Walter Beck." Inspector Walter Beck was summoned and he accompanied Bowyer back to Miller's Court. Seeing the ghastly sight before him, he immediately sent word for the police surgeon, George Baxter Phillips, to attend. He also ensured that the crime scene was cordoned off and sent dispatches to Scotland Yard requesting that bloodhounds be brought to the scene. It had been discussed after previous murders that using bloodhounds as a resource may lead to the identity of the murderer. Superintendent Thomas Arnold and Detective Inspector Edmund Reed from the Metropolitan Police H Division made their way to the scene, as did Detective Inspector Frederick Abberline and Assistant Police Commissioner Robert Anderson from Scotland Yard. Whilst the first officers were said to have arrived on scene at about 11 o'clock, nobody had entered the premises. It was deemed appropriate to wait for the arrival of the bloodhounds for fear of contaminating evidence. When word was received that the dogs were not going to be deployed, Superintendent Arnold ordered that the room be entered. It was now 1:30 p.m. The door was locked from the inside, so entry was gained by force. Nobody who experienced the horrors of what was left in that small room would ever be able to forget what they saw, nor could they ever understand how any man could cause such harm to a fellow human being. It contravenes every fibre of humanity and decency.
Even after all this time, I cannot help but feel repulsed, angry, and shocked by this most dreadful event. What gives anybody the right to think that they can do this to another human being? It was a brutal and senseless attack upon a young girl who had already known so much hardship in her short-lived life. It defies all logic and cannot, even in this world of heightened understanding and compassion, be excused nor explained away. It was an evil, wicked act. Nothing more, nothing less. I feel so desperately sorry for Mary Jane, to have overcome so many obstacles in her young life, only to have it ended in such a brutal and sadistic manner. She was laid to rest at St. Patrick's Roman Catholic Cemetery in Leytonstone on the 19th of November 1888, in a service attended by Joseph Barnett, several acquaintances, and a representative of John McCarthy. The inscription upon her grave reads, "In loving memory of Marie Jeanette Kelly, none but the lonely hearts can know my sadness. Love lives forever."
I was only 25. You took my future away from me.
Mary Jane's whole life seemed to have been an enigma. Most of what we know about her came from the stories she told Joseph Barnett about herself. Even in death, this aspect didn't change, as there is a mystery surrounding that too. The faint cry of murder was heard by the neighbours at about 4 a.m, suggesting that the time of death would have been around the same time. Certainly the condition of the body when examined, and the injuries she had sustained, would suggest that the time of death would not have been much later than that.
It is of great interest, therefore, that a witness came forward at the inquest to suggest that she had not only seen Mary Jane as late as 9 a.m. on the morning of the 9th of November 1888, she also had a brief conversation with her. This was less than 2 hours before her body was discovered by Thomas Bowyer.
The witness was Caroline Maxwell, who lived opposite the entrance to Miller's Court at 14 Dorset Street. She told the inquest that she'd seen Mary Jane in Dorset Street at about 8:15 that morning, as she'd been surprised to see her up and about so early in the morning. She recounted a short exchange she'd had in which Maxwell had asked, "Why? What brings you up so early?" To which Mary Jane had replied, "Oh, Carrie, I do feel so bad." Maxwell went on to say that she advised Mary Jane to visit Mrs. Ringer's pub and have a half pint of beer, to which Mary Jane replied that she already had, but had bought it up again, pointing to some vomit on the cobblestones nearby. Maxwell left Dorset Street to run an errand, but returned shortly before 9 a.m. and says she saw Mary Jane outside the Britannia pub, speaking with a man who was wearing market porter's clothing. She even went on to describe the man as being 35 years old, stout, and about 5 feet 5 inches tall. The details within Maxwell's testimony appear too irrefutable to be an invention or fabrication. What possible cause could Maxwell have for making something like this up? Could it be that Maxwell was mistaken about the date? Or is it conceivable that the poor girl who was murdered within 13 Miller's Court on the 9th of November 1888 was not Mary Jane Kelly after all?
Episode 5 featured Anne Marie O'Rorty as Mary Jane Kelly, with narration by Sarah Robinson, Daniel O'Rorty, and Dave Andrew. Music was provided courtesy of YouTube, and was None But the Lonely Hearts by Tchaikovsky, and A Violet Plucked from Mother's Grave, which is an Irish traditional song. The title music was created by the Power Music Factory. This production was devised and produced by Dave Andrew, using historic documents and reports from the time, along with information gleaned from dedicated websites, books, and documentaries. Thank you for listening. Please join us again for episode 6.
Remember me.